Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
What is the beginning? It's a simple word, but difficult to define, in part because it admits of many applications. Beginning is a relative term. It always points to something beyond itself. Thus, to speak of a beginning necessarily includes a reference to something or things that follow from it. Looking back to a beginning already involves some recognition of what has come after. And there are as many beginnings as there are stories we tell about ourselves, our lives, our origins, and ultimately of the origin of all things, of the universe itself. Obviously, one thinks here of the opening words of the Bible, in the beginning. Now, when Aristotle writes about beginnings, he reminds us that a small mistake in the beginning often expands exponentially to produce error after error. This admonition has a special relevance to discussions with respect to cosmological, philosophical, and theological claims about the beginning of the universe, and especially the relationship between claims in cosmology and traditional understandings of the doctrine of creation. An initial error about different senses of what it means to begin is the beginning of all sorts of errors about the relationship between the doctrine of creation and the discoveries of contemporary science. Such errors often lead to a further error, to think that advances in cosmology have eliminated the need for a creator. This conclusion that there is no need for a creator has its beginning in a fundamental error about the various beginnings that the natural sciences, philosophy, and theology address. What can cosmologists tell us about the creation of the universe? An answer to this question requires us to be clear about the explanatory domains of the natural sciences, philosophy, and theology. In such an enterprise, there is no better guide than Thomas Aquinas. Perhaps it seems strange to argue that what Thomas Aquinas has to say about creation and science can speak directly to debates in our own day about the philosophical and theological implications of current cosmological speculations. Despite dangers of falling into anachronistic commentary, or of failing to recognize profound differences in the ways in which terms such as science, creation, and time have come to be used in the centuries that separate us from Thomas Aquinas, when it comes to drawing philosophical and theological conclusions from contemporary cosmology, insights from the Middle Ages remain valuable. Astronomers often note that to look out at the heavens is to look back in time. Perhaps to look back in time to medieval discussions of creation and science will help us to look out more clearly and to avoid confusions about both what we are seeing and what the implications of contemporary science are. But before looking back to Thomas, I want to provide a brief survey of some current cosmological claims related to creation. Recent developments in cosmology have been used to reach philosophical and theological conclusions about the beginning of the universe. In the grand design, this is going to be quotation number two on your handout. In the grand design, Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow make the point that just as the universe has no edge, so there is no boundary, no beginning to time. Therefore, they think to ask what happened before the beginning or even at the beginning would be meaningless. Quotation number two from Hawking and Mlodinow. In the early universe, when the universe was small enough to be governed by both general relativity and quantum theory, there were effectively four dimensions of space and none of time. That means that when we speak of the beginning of the universe, we are skirting the subtle issue that as we look backward toward the very early universe, time as we know it does not exist. We must accept that our usual ideas of space and time do not apply to the very early universe. That is beyond our experience, but not beyond our imagination. Hawking thinks, or thought, perhaps in the past tense, that nothing caused the Big Bang because there was no time at such a putative beginning. Time is something which comes into existence in an evolving universe. For him and for most people, the relationship between cause and effect is essentially a temporal one. That is, a cause always precedes temporally its effect. When he applies this understanding of cause and effect to his cosmology that allows no time in which a creator would exist prior to what he creates, Hawking concludes that since there is no time, hence no causal nexus, therefore there is no creator. Recent theories concerning what happened before the Big Bang, as well as those that speak of an endless series of Big Bangs or some version of a multiverse hypothesis, are often attractive because they too deny a fundamental beginning to the universe and thus appear to make a creator irrelevant. Indeed, there's a desire in some cosmological circles to get rid of the troubling singularity of the Big Bang itself, a singularity that seems to indicate a beginning of the universe. Such theories, what happened before the Big Bang, allow cosmologists like Neil Torok and Paul Steinhardt to claim that the Big Bang is not the beginning of space and time, but rather an event that is in principle fully describable using physical laws. Nor does the Big Bang happen only once. Instead, the universe undergoes cycles of evolution. This is a particularly common theory among contemporary cosmologists. Some cosmologists have used insights from quantum mechanics to offer accounts of the Big Bang itself. They speak of the Big Bang in terms of quantum tunneling from nothing, analogous to the way in which very small particles seem to emerge spontaneously from vacuums in laboratory experiments. Thus, they think that to explain the Big Bang in this way, as the fluctuation of a primal vacuum, eliminates the need to have a creator and leads to the conclusion that physics itself is competent to explain the very beginning of the universe. One cosmologist, Alexander Vilenkin, argues that although he thinks the universe has a beginning, modern physics can describe the emergence of this universe as a physical process that does not require a cause. This is quotation number three on your handout. Vilenkin. What causes the universe to pop out of nothing? No cause is needed. If you have a radioactive atom, it will decay. And quantum mechanics gives the decay probability in a given interval of time, say a minute. There's no reason why the atom decayed at this particular moment and not another. The process is completely random. No cause is needed for the quantum creation of the universe. It's a random process. Now, there are other thinkers who have embraced traditional Big Bang cosmology that seems to affirm an absolute beginning to the universe, as providing scientific justification for, if not actual confirmation of, the Genesis account of creation. The argument here is that an initial singularity, the Big Bang, outside the categories of space and time, points to a supernatural cause of the beginning of the universe. This is quotation number 4 coming up on your handout from William Lane Craig. William Lane Craig, one of the better known proponents of this position, outlines his argument in a simple syllogism, number 4. 1. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. 2. The universe began to exist. That's the Big Bang cosmology. The universe began to exist. 3. Therefore, the universe has a cause. That is created. Now, Craig's argument appears to have an immediate appeal. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. In addition to referring to contemporary Big Bang cosmology to support the conclusion that the universe is temporally finite and thus created, Craig also invokes philosophical arguments about the impossibility of past times being infinite, an impossibility that leads ineluctably to the conclusion that the universe has a beginning. These complex philosophical arguments, which we can talk about if you like, but fundamentally, Craig thinks that the notion of a universe without a beginning is absurd because it would mean that past time is infinite and you can't have an infinite dimension of time. So that's a philosophical argument supporting the view that the universe has a beginning in addition to cosmology. In addition to whether or not cosmology discloses a beginning to the universe, there is also a more explicitly philosophical debate about whether any beginning to the universe requires a cause. With respect to this question about causality, physicist Sean Carroll, in his book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself, says, and this is quotation 5 on your handout from Carroll, causation is a derived notion rather than a fundamental one. It's best thought of as acting within individual theories that rely on the concept, causation. The notion of cause, he says, is not the right vocabulary to use when thinking about how the universe works at a deep level. Carroll argues that the first premise in Craig's syllogism, whatever begins to exist as a cause, he thinks that first premise is false. Indeed, Carroll rejects the legitimacy of asking for a cause of the universe itself. And this is a very interesting long quotation number 6 from Sean Carroll. Why should we expect that there are causes or explanations or a reason why in the universe in which we live? It is because the physical world inside of which we are embedded has two important features. There are unbreakable patterns, laws of physics. Things do not just happen, they obey laws. And there is an arrow of time stretching from the past to the future. The entropy was lower in the past and increases towards the future. Therefore, when you find some event or state of affairs B today, we can very often trace it back in time to one or a couple of possible predecessor events that we therefore call the causes of that, which leads to B according to the laws of physics. But crucially, both of these features of the universe that allow us to speak the language of causes and effects are completely absent when we talk about the universe as a whole. See, causality concerns things which happen within the universe. They're absent when we speak about the universe as a whole. We do not think that our universe is part of a bigger ensemble that obeys laws. Even if it is a part of the multiverse is not part of a bigger ensemble that obeys laws. Therefore, nothing gives us the right to demand some kind of external cause of the universe. Now, Carroll is here confusing one kind of causality, that between temporally separated events, with a much richer and broader notion of cause. He thinks that causality follows from the laws of nature. There are the laws of nature, therefore there's causality. When in fact, I think it's just the opposite. Laws of nature reflect causality. Indeed, laws of nature reflect the causal relations that exist in the world, and thus these laws of nature depend upon the priority of causal relations. In rejecting the application of his restricted notion of cause to the question of the cause of the universe, Harrow, I think, mistakenly concludes that he shows the falsity of traditional arguments for a cause of existence of such. For example, such as an uncaused cause. Those arguments don't work because they proceed, according to Carroll, because they proceed from mistaken notions of causality. Although I think, and we'll talk more about this later, that Carroll's notion itself is mistaken. In discussions about creation and beginnings, there is a further confusion. This concerns the meaning of nothing in the expression creation out of nothing. The tendency is to think that coming to be out of nothing must refer to a beginning. First nothing, and something else. But a counter-argument is to say that an eternal universe, one without a beginning, cannot, of course, be created out of nothing. Not only because there is no beginning, but also because for something to come out of nothing would violate a first principle of all science. That first principle of all science, from nothing, nothing can come. All changes that the natural sciences study, for all the changes that they study, any coming into existence requires something prior from which the change occurs. But I think just as there are confusions about beginning, so there are confusions about nothing, as well as confusions about what coming into existence means. And I'll be talking more about this in a moment. Now, Alexander Vilenkin, who I already mentioned, who accepts the version of quantum tunneling from nothing as a description of the origin of the universe, notes that the nothing in his account is, quote, this is quotation number 8 on your handout. Nothing, according to Vilenkin, is a state with no classical space-time, the realm of unrestrained quantum gravity. It is a rather bizarre state in which all our basic notions of space, time, energy, entropy, etc., lose their meaning. Vilenkin offers the following thought experiment. Imagine space-time as the surface of a sphere, and then suppose that the sphere is shrinking, like a balloon losing its air. As the radius grows smaller, it eventually goes to zero. The surface of the sphere disappears, and with it, space-time itself. He then says, we have arrived at nothingness. Important to know where to go, find it. We've arrived at nothingness. We've also arrived at a precise definition of nothingness, a closed space-time of zero radius. It is mathematically devoid not only of stuff, but also of location and duration. The notion of nothing, which is appropriate for contemporary physics, points of Vilenkin. The nothing in some of these cosmological models that speak of the Big Bang as quantum tunneling from nothing, that nothing is not the nothing referred to in traditional senses of creation out of nothing. The nothing in all these cosmological reflections may very well be nothing like our present universe, but it is not the absolute nothing central to what it means to create. It is only that about which the theories say nothing. I'm sometimes introduced by my friends as the person who goes around the world making distinctions about nothing. Despite a widespread interest in nothing, the nothing to which many authors refer is really something, even at times a quasi-ambiguous reality. But the nothing in the traditional understanding of creation out of nothing only refers to the absence of everything other than God. Now, of course, in a way, to speak of other than God risks the danger of locating God and things on the same metaphysical plane, perhaps differing only in degree. Nor ought we to think that creation out of nothing means that there are somehow two realities, two ultimate principles, God and nothing. But as we shall see in a few moments, creation out of nothing does not mean that God changes nothing into something. Rather, creation out of nothing is a way of affirming that it is God alone and nothing else who is the cause of absolutely everything that is. What I've been suggesting so far is that, in a way, the current debate is primarily about whether or not cosmology discloses the beginning of the universe. Hawking, for example, denies the intelligibility of such a notion of beginning. Others argue for variations of an eternal universe. William Lane Craig and others claim that current cosmology does indeed point to a beginning. The debate framed in such terms about a beginning lead the exponents either to reject or to embrace the idea of creation. Despite fundamental differences as to what contemporary cosmology tells us, all these views tend to identify what it means for the universe to be created with the universe's having a temporal beginning. This emphasis on beginnings leads to confusions about creation. The error here is to think that creation necessarily means that the universe has a temporal beginning. If creation and beginnings are connected in this way, it becomes easy to see how a denial of there being a beginning leads to a denial of creation, and that an affirmation of a scientific account of a beginning leads to an affirmation of creation. Again, my point is that confusions concerning creation and cosmology run the gamut from denials of creation because the universe is conceived as having no beginning, to explanations of a beginning in exclusively scientific terms which avoid any appeal to a creator, to denying the intelligibility of asking questions about the cause of the universe itself, and then to opposing claims that the Big Bang offers a kind of scientific warrant for belief in God's creation of the universe. All of these theories, both in favor of and opposed to the idea of creation, share what I have called the error of beginnings. But if creation ought not to be identified necessarily with the beginning of the universe, what does creation mean? We now switch to more philosophical analysis. Now, on the handout, starting with quotation number 10, all these things in italics are my words. I put them on the handout so you can have them because they represent sort of a crucial argument I'm making. Contrary to all these claims that use cosmology either to deny or affirm creation, we need to recognize that creation is a metaphysical, this is number 10, and theological affirmation, that all it is in whatever way or way it is depends upon God as cause. The natural sciences, including cosmology, have as their subject the world of changing things, from subatomic particles to acorns to galaxies. Whenever there's a change, there must be something that changes. Whether these changes are biological or cosmological, without beginning or end or temporally finite, they remain processes. The scientific principle that from nothing, nothing comes is true. But it is the truth with respect to the changes that occur within the world. Creation, on the other hand, is the radical causing of the whole existence of whatever exists. Creation is not a change. To cause completely something to exist is not to produce a change in something, is not to work on or with some existing material. At the very least, this is the traditional understanding of creation. Number 10, quotation 10 continues. Cosmology and all the other natural sciences offer accounts of change. They do not address the metaphysical and theological questions of creation. They do not speak to why there is something rather than nothing. It is a mistake to use arguments in the natural sciences to deny creation. It is also a mistake to appeal to cosmology as a confirmation of creation. Now, discussions of creation are different from arguments from order and design in the world to a source of order and design. Similarly, discussions about the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe do not directly concern the topic of creation. Thus, whether or not multiverse theories do away with the need to explain such fine-tuning, these theories do not provide a commentary on creation. Creation offers an explanation of why things exist at all. It may very well be that natural philosophy, working with the discoveries of the empirical sciences, can lead us to the knowledge of the existence of God, the arguments from motion to an unmoved mover, for example. But this would not yet be knowledge of God as creator. For this type of knowledge, we need metaphysics and ultimately revelation. Now, my analysis thus far has been heavily influenced by the thought of Thomas Aquinas, but now I want to be a little more explicit in my reference to him. Already in the 13th century, the groundwork was set for the fundamental understanding of creation and its relationship to the natural sciences. Working within the context of Aristotelian science, and aided by the insights of Muslim and Jewish thinkers, as well as his Christian predecessors, Thomas Aquinas provided an analysis of creation and science which remains true. One of the key texts from Thomas is from his treatise on separate substances. This is quotation number 11 on your handout. He writes, "Over and above the mode of becoming by which something comes to be through change and motion, there must be a mode of becoming or origin of things without any mutation or motion through the influx of being." By the way, that little phrase in English, "there must be," that's a claim for a rational demonstration. That's why it must be. For Thomas, creation means a dependence in being. And that's a notion in metaphysics, what it means for things to be, not in the natural sciences. To be caused to be by God means to be dependent upon God for the fact that one is. The relationship here between divine cause and created effect is one of metaphysical dependence. Indeed, the fundamental sense of causality involves, first of all, dependence, and not any temporal relationship prior and posterior. So if you think that causality fundamentally means a temporal sequence, cause and effect, that's a very limited notion of causality. It lacks a full understanding of what a cause is. Notice that Thomas here in this quotation distinguishes between the mode of becoming by which something comes to be through change or motion, from the more fundamental sense of creation that he identifies as the influx of being. The latter, the influx of being, is the causing of existence as such. And that little phrase, "as such," is important. It helps us to recognize the difference between causing something to come to be or to exist in the ways in which, for example, animals produce offspring. Animals cause their offspring to exist. But when we talk about causing resistance as such, we're talking about God's causing of the actuality of whatever is as it is. And that's a more profound sense of causing of resistance. Now, Thomas's philosophical analysis of the complete dependence of all existing things, precisely as existing, occurs in the discipline of metaphysics. And it involves a profound understanding of the difference between what a thing is and the very existence of a thing and the existence of all its features. Thomas argues that an existing thing cannot be the fundamental cause of its own existence. Causing of existence in this fundamental sense is what creation is. So right now, everything which exists in this room, including the thoughts in your mind, the taste on your, everything that exists is caused to be by God, or it would not exist at all. There is nothing about reality, either in its the things which exist, or the features of things, or the ideas, which is not caused by God. Otherwise, it would not be at all. Your free choice exists. God causes it to exist, or it would not be. God causes your free choice to be your free choice. We can talk about some of that. So this is this radical sense of the causing of existence of whatever is in whatever ways. So the coolness of the night air, the coolness exists. It's real. God causes the coolness to be the coolness and the air to be the air. This is this fundamental sense of creation. As Thomas often notes, creatio non est mutatio. Creation is not a change. I have my Chinese audience, undergraduates and graduates, if I wanted to express, say these words, creatio non est mutatio, on the subway and the trains of China, because my goal is to have 1.4 billion Chinese, including President Xi, muttering the expression in Latin, creatio non est mutatio. The doctrine of creation tells us why there is something rather than nothing. And this is a topic in a category beyond the explanatory domain of the natural sciences, because the explanatory domain of the natural sciences explain change of all different types, big, small, whatever. And creatio non est mutatio. And there's a quotation from Thomas number 12 on your handout, which makes this point. Now, number 13, back to me. When speaking about the origin of the universe, understood of God's causing it to come into existence, Thomas Aquinas observes that there are two complementary senses of creation of a nothing, one philosophical, the other theological. The philosophical sense of creation means that God, with no material cause, makes all things to exist as beings that are radically different from himself and yet completely dependent upon his causality. This philosophical sense of creation, which I've been defending, has two essential elements. One, there is no material cause in creation, no stuff whatsoever out of which God makes the world. And two, the creature, and of course the coolness of the night air is a creature, a creature represents anything caused by God. The creature is completely dependent throughout its entire duration upon the constant causality of the creator. The philosophical sense of creation is the sense in which creation out of nothing is a subject in metaphysics, concerning the complete dependence of all that is on a cause of existence. As Thomas notes in several places, quote, not only does faith hold that there is creation, reason also demonstrates creation. Anyone with reason in the discipline of metaphysics can come to know with certainty that all that is created by God. The demonstration to which Thomas referred, the demonstrations are in metaphysics, and one of the more famous begins with the distinction between existence and essence of things, for example, between what it means to be any creature, its essence, and which does not include the existence of the creature. Thus, the argument concludes this particular demonstration with the necessity of there being a reality God for whom or in whom this distinction between essence and existence disappears. What it means to be God, God's essence, is simply to be. Now, I've given you a small passage from the De Ena on being in essence, quotation 14 on your handout, which summarizes that argument. And although, so my point tonight is not so much that argument, but the fact of what Thomas is claiming here, but we can talk about that if you like. So creation is not primarily some distant event. Rather, it's the ongoing, complete causing of the existence of all that is. At this very moment, were God not causing all that is to exist, there would be nothing at all. Creation concerns, first of all, the origin of the universe, not its temporal beginning. Indeed, it's important to recognize the distinction between origin and beginning. The former, origin here, affirms the complete continuing dependence of all that is on God as cause. Whatever is created has its origin in God, but we ought not to think that to be created must mean that whatever is created has a temporal beginning. It may very well be that the universe had a temporal beginning, as the traditional interpretation of the opening of Genesis acknowledges, but there is no contradiction in the notion of an eternal created universe. For were the universe to be without a beginning, it still would have an origin. It still would be created. As we've already seen in Stephen Hawking's denial of God's causing the universe to be because there is no time, hence no temporal priority, hence no causality to be exercised. And for him, cause and effect are necessarily seen as involving a temporal sequence. But Thomas can speak of an eternal universe as being caused by God because he does not limit the relationship between cause and effect to a temporal sequence. And of course, he distinguishes between God's causality and the causality which creatures exercise. God's causality as creator is indeed prior to the created effect. But the priority is not a temporal priority. It is the failure to recognize that to be created does not necessarily entail a temporal beginning that causes considerable confusion in contemporary debates about the implications of cosmology for arguments about whether or not the universe is created. This error about beginnings continues to be the beginning of all sorts of errors about what cosmology can properly describe and what creation is. Now, Thomas thought that neither science nor philosophy could know whether the universe had a beginning. He did think, as I've suggested, that metaphysics could show us for sure that the universe is created. A world with a temporal beginning concerns the kind of world God has created. It may very well be easier to accept that a world which has an absolute temporal beginning is created, and such a world may be especially appropriate for understanding sacred history, important as such history is for believers. But an eternal world, one without a beginning to time, would be no less a created world than a world with an absolute beginning. Thomas Aquinas, of course, believed that the universe had a temporal beginning. This was the common view of the Church Fathers and was first solemnly proclaimed as Church dogma in the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. Thomas recognized that what was given in faith, that the universe had a temporal beginning, completed and perfected what reason could know about creation. After all, reason itself, the metaphysics for Thomas, accounted for creation without any reference to temporality. So to include the notion of an absolute beginning adds to the concept of creation. But Thomas would have warned against those today who use Big Bang cosmology, for example, to conclude that the universe has a beginning and therefore must be created. He warned against such views. He was always alert to reject the use of bad arguments in support of what is believed. Quotation 15 from Thomas. That the world had a beginning is an object of faith, but not a demonstration or science. And we do well to keep this in mind. Otherwise, if we presumptuously undertake to demonstrate what is of faith, we may introduce arguments that are not strictly conclusive. And this would furnish infidels, people from the naval academy, infidels with an occasion for scoffing, as they would think that we assent to truths of faith on such grounds. This would be his criticism of William Lane Craig and others. So the singularity in traditional Big Bang cosmology may represent the beginning of the universe we observe, but we cannot conclude that it is the absolute beginning, the kind of beginning which might indicate creation. And indeed, as some contemporary cosmologists recognize, there may very well be something before the Big Bang. So now, a few concluding remarks. This is number 16 on the handout, again for me. Cosmological theories are easily used, or rather misused, to support or to deny creation. Each time, however, as I have suggested, to create has been joined inextricably to temporal finitude, such that to be created necessarily means to begin to be. Thus, to deny a beginning is to deny creation. It was the genius of Thomas Aquinas to distinguish between creation understood philosophically with no reference to temporality and creation understood theologically, which included the recognition that the universe does not have an absolute temporal beginning. Finally, there's a wider confusion at work here as well, wider than the confusing of creation with beginning. It is the failure to distinguish between creation and the changes that occur within the created order, and hence the failure to recognize that the natural sciences, including cosmology, have nothing to tell us about the ultimate cause of existence of all things. You see, God's creative power is exercised throughout the entire course of cosmic history in whatever ways that history has unfolded. No explanations of cosmological or biological change, or the evolutionary arguments, no matter how radically random or contingent such explanations claim to be in biology and cosmology. None of those explanations challenges the metaphysical account of creation, that is, of the dependence of the existence of all things upon God as cause. When some thinkers deny creation on the basis of theories in the natural sciences, or use cosmology to confirm creation, or reject the conclusions of science in defense of creation, they misunderstand creation or the natural sciences or both. We need to avoid the error of thinking that discussions in the natural sciences about beginnings have anything to tell us about the creation of the universe. Thank you very much. And of course, I should always include the Go Army behavior.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.